Something that that almost goes without saying now is that today we have access to more information than anyone ever has had before in human history. I think that it's also true to say that, our ability to absorb information, our ability of our brains to absorb information, has not changed very much over time. So that leads us to this question. Given that we have all this information we have access to, how do we go about organizing that in a way that we can even know what we know and get at it in an efficient way, a way that can make it useful? That is one of the kinds of questions that we will try to explore in this part of Focus 580 as we talk with Kati Borner. She is Associate Professor of Information Science at the School of Library Science at Indiana University, where she is also Adjunct Associate Professor of Informatics, is on the Core Faculty of Cognitive Science, and is also a research affiliate in the of the Biocomplexity Institute at Indiana. She is here to give a talk in a series that's sponsored in part by the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and also at the folks at the Center for Advanced Study, looking at this very question and sort of applying the idea of the map that we have long used to try to, in a graphic way, represent the world, the geographic world, and take that idea, the idea of the map, and apply that to how it is we think about ideas. She's going to be giving a talk at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications building this afternoon at 1, and Mapping the Structure and Diffusion of Scholarly Knowledge is the title. I think anybody who is interested in attending this should certainly feel welcome. And here in this part of the show, as we talk, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, you can certainly give us a call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. David already mentioned, mankind's knowledge is today stored in an exponentially increasing number of papers and patents and emails and news and blogs. And no man and no machine can actually process this enormous amount of information. Some research communities produce as many as 40,000 papers every month, and it's clear that nobody can read this anymore. And the semantic tagging technologies, which we have developed for ourselves, do a not so good job in actually retrieving what we really need to know, because we as human beings turn out to be very creative in the usage of words, especially if it comes to titles, and even if it comes to abstracts, very different styles are used across the different scientific communities. So knowledge gets reinvented and science fragments at an increasing speed, and it's very, very hard to actually interrelate pieces of knowledge that should be connected. And the question then becomes, how can we utilize our collective knowledge better? How we can we interlink the dots? And how can we grow and support and feed this global brain which is evolving on our planet? Clearly today, my students and maybe also many of you use search engines to retrieve and query everything which we collectively know. And they do a great job in helping us find facts. And they, however, don't really help us to see how big this growing sea of knowledge actually is, where the useful islands of knowledge are, where areas are that you should invest resources in. And this is where cartographic maps come in, or the mapping of knowledge also. And many of you, if you have to go to a new city or country or state, you actually consult a map and find out how to get there and what you're going to encounter there, if they have an old town or if it's a urban sprawl area. And you use maps to guide your explorations. And in fact, cartographic maps have guided mankind's explorations for many, many centuries. There is a new type of map makers active since about 10 years now. And those new map makers of science, they actually mine large amounts of scholarly data, being it publications and patents and grants, terabytes of data which need to be integrated and interlinked and analyzed to map our collective scholarly knowledge on a global scale. And these maps of knowledge can then also be used to drive into most promising areas of research, but to also get global views which can be used for teaching different topics, but they can also be used to identify emerging research frontiers. So we did a number of studies, but I was wondering what kind of questions my partner here had for me.
Well, it may be just to stay with the idea of the map and using that. I think people will get the idea that, well, I understand what a map is. I understand that it's a way of representing on a piece of paper the physical world, mm-hmm. so that you can find your way mm-hmm. around. Mm-hmm. And people get that. And we use maps all the time mm-hmm. from the time that we're little. You know,
right.
We get that idea. I think that though people might not be able to make the leap from the idea of using a map to represent a physical space, something that's really real and you can stand on and you can walk on, to something like the branches of knowledge and specialization, say, within a particular
right.
field. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, in a larger sense, you could even, I know it'd be a big challenge, but you could say, we could take all of scientific knowledge. I mean, it was just going to be a big map, maybe. Mm-hmm. But you can take all of scientific knowledge and in a way, represent that space, that conceptual space that all those fields inhabit and how they are connected to each other, mm-hmm. you know, in some sort of sense. That I think that I understand the idea, but also I think that some people would say, well, I'm not really sure what you mean by that or what you end up with.
Okay. So the easiest reference system which you could use for science, and we today do not know what reference system is actually the best one to use, but the easiest one would just be a timeline. So you plot the major events, major inventions, inventors over time. Second attempt you could do is to map it over geospatial space. So you take a map of Illinois, for instance, and you identify those major research institutions, universities, companies which exist in this geospatial region. You also map the pockets of innovation. You map the pathways which ideas take to make it into products. And you might also be interested to look at the interplay of academic institutions and industry. And similarly, you could also come up with a completely new semantic or topic map. And actually, two of my collaborators, Kevin Boyack and Dick Clavans, they have embarked upon mapping science on a really grand, large scale based on data from Thomson ISI, which also provides the Web of Science, which serves the Social Science and Science Citation Index. And given this enormous amount of mostly journal publications, mostly in English-speaking language, they have mapped science on a large scale. And what you then get is looks like a donut. So fortunately, nothing ended up being in the middle. And particularly, this is mapped based on a spring force embedding layout algorithms. So those journals which are cited, or papers which are cited a lot together, they are assumed to be similar to each other. And those journals which are not cited a lot with each other, they are pushed more away from each other. And then this donut, which results from this spatial layouts of millions of papers which have been published, can be rotated and mirrored because the force-directed placement algorithm doesn't care about mirroring or rotation. But you can rotate it in a way and mirror it in a way that mathematics is at the top of all of science as the purest, most theoretical area of science. And if you go in clockwise directions, then physics ends up at kind of 2 o'clock, chemistry 3 to 4 o'clock, the biomedical sciences between 5 o'clock and let's say 8 o'clock. Starting at 9 o'clock, there's the social sciences with psychology and statistics and back into math. And computer science, my field, actually hovers right underneath mathematics. And the nice thing about this topic map is that you actually get to see how big certain areas of science are. And given that there are citation linkages between papers, you can also see which areas eat off the results of other areas of science. And then, of course, you can do projections. What, for instance, would happen if you don't fund mathematics anymore? Who is going to suffer from this? Or similarly, how much is education going to suffer if psychology is not funded anymore, or not to the degree they are now? Or if you fund it more, how much would education actually benefit from it?
Hmm. Well, I can see where, well, it, I'm sure that, what the people in math argue is that sooner or later, everything comes down to math, and that would make them happy to know that they were at the top, and also would make them happy to know that this is a way that they can say, look, we better be funding math, or else everything else is just going to fall apart. Now, it may in fact do that for you, but and I suppose the other thing that it does for people who are interested in sort of the structure of science, in a sense, how different areas relate to each other, mm-hmm. What things are really most important in the sense that they underpin everything mm-hmm. else. So if you're interested in the landscape of science, I can see what that would do for you. But is there some practical way, something that it will enable you to do, actually, that you could not do otherwise without having that map to see how things are sort of arranged and how things are connected?
There are many, many different user groups which actually have started to use those prototypical maps, and it's really just in the beginning. Cartography, geography is thousands of years old. These new maps of science are really just 10 years old. So we are still learning how to generate them best, what metaphors are actually using to use, and what kind of reference systems will work best. But one user group we have obviously in mind are children. And so I recently went with some of my students to my 6-year-old daughter's class. She is in first grade now, and they have community visitors. And so what we did was to, first of all, in the first session, to introduce them to Google Maps. And the children had real fun to actually go to the places where their grandma lives. And some of them lived far away in Poland and in Japan. And so they flew in there and figured out the street. And others went to UK because their dad was on a business trip there. And then in the next session, the subsequent week, we went there and we had maps of sciences with us. And we told them about the explorers of our planet and how Columbus discovered America. And they obviously were familiar with those stories, and they could immediately place people to geospatial places. And then we had them map inventors and inventions onto the map of science. And surprisingly, they just took it on. They just did it, basically. We were very surprised to see this. And obviously, there are lots of issues connected to where to place somebody who makes major contributions to multiple domains of science, such as, for instance, Albert Einstein. Should you cut him into three pieces and place him to three different places, or should you place him in the middle, which might be nowhere land? And I think it's this kind of discussion which actually then have them realize the impact that one person might have had. And I think the discussion about where to place Einstein in this case is very, very valuable in itself. We also, at the end of the session, ask them where they want to be, where they want to have their place in science. And many of them, it was very surprising to me, they knew that they are going to be a physicist, a nuclear physicist. Was actually a girl, which was very cool. And they just placed themselves down and marked their place.
How old was this girl who knew already she was going to be?
Seven.
She already knew she was going to be a nuclear physicist at seven. Well, the thing that among the many things I think is interesting about this is that apparently for them they didn't really have such a difficult time going from the idea of map as a description of a physical space mm-hmm. to the idea of map as a description of a landscape of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that their parents might have a hard time making that step. But for them, apparently, there was no problem for them making that step.
No, and I think it has to do that they learn in school the map of the world. They are used to learning those maps. And imagine now that in each school you would not only have the political map of the world, but you would also learn a reference system for mankind's knowledge. And this could be either a geospatial map or a timeline or this semantic map, this donut map, which I referred to before. You would just learn it as you go through your school and you would see, oh, physics is over now. Okay, let's leave this space. I go over to biology next and I know those are connected and this is the area where actually physicists and biologists work right now. And I also know that there are these cool new research frontiers in those areas. Maybe I check them out online. Maybe it's even a clickable map and I can go there. And you could also even see major fundings which went into certain areas or breakthrough results. And I think the ultimate hope is that at some point you would even have kind of science weather forecasts either on TV or online or both, so that people get really back this bird's eye view, which maybe Leonardo da Vinci and others had, but these birds and global views of scientific structure and evolution are long gone. And right now we really try to interconnect the dots while being on the floor, searching for facts, using search engines, but we never get an up button.
Hmm. And I guess something else that I know you're interested in is that how it is that we have, and perhaps this has something to do with the increasing fact that information is digitized and accessed and moved around in digital form, that it is increasingly possible and does increasingly happen, is that people, within science, it seems there's much more collaboration, perhaps, than there has been in the past. And that it's not so much a matter of maybe individual people who are exceptional in the sense that they make connections between things that other people can't see. But it's now, because it's easier for different people who may be separated by geography, if not separated by the fields that they're in, possible for them to connect, get their ideas together, and come up with something that on their own they would not have been able to do.
Definitely. And it is interesting. Actually, you can take, for instance, this donut-shaped map and just query for all articles related to nanotechnology. And you will see it highlighting in major areas of physics and biology and mathematics and many others. Or you can just select proteomics. And again, you will see it's at major chunks of scientific disciplines. And this is a visualization which actually Dick Boyack and Dick Clavans and Kevin Boyack generated, and which is on display in the New York Public Library right now. And I should make this plug, actually, before I forget it. So there is currently an exhibit which is called Places and Spaces, Mapping Science, on display at the Science, Industry and Business Library at the New York Public Library in New York, which features 20 maps of sciences. And in particular, there are two iterations of this exhibit on display, one which compares and contrasts metaphors which could be useful for mapping science, and a second one which compares and contrasts reference systems which might be useful for mapping sciences on a large scale. And we would like to encourage the general public to provide feedback and also to start and initiate a discussion on how to best depict science, how to depict what we collectively know. One of the centerpieces of this exhibit is a display, a so-called illuminated diagram display, which shows on the left-hand side a map of science, this donut-shaped map, which I have mentioned before, and on the right-hand side a geospatial map. And in the so-called attractor mode, you just see a kind of radar sweep going over the map of science. And whenever one of those major scientific topics is hit, you actually see on the geospatial map where this particular type of science is conducted. So imagine it hits biochemistry. Then actually on the geospatial map, you will see what areas, geospatial areas and institutions conduct this science and how many papers have been published there. And if the next node, let's say chemistry, is hit, then you would see where chemistry research is produced and results are produced. You can then also interactively manipulate the display by clicking, using a touch display, clicking on the geospatial map, and then you would see what kind of research is actually conducted at in Illinois, for instance.
We are almost at our midpoint. We have some callers that we'll take just to write in a moment here, but I should introduce again our guest, Kati Borner. She is an associate professor of information science at Indiana University in Bloomington. She's also adjunct associate professor of informatics, core faculty member of cognitive science, and research affiliate of the Biocomplexity Institute. She is here visiting the campus to take part in an initiative that's sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study. It's their initiative on the age of networks, social, cultural, and technological connections. And she is part of a distinguished speaker series that is co-sponsored by the folks at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and also the folks in the Department of Speech Communication. I get a mention in of everybody. She'll be giving a talk on the title Mapping the Structure and Diffusion of Scientific or Scholarly Knowledge this afternoon at 1 in room 1040 at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications building, which is right across the street, actually, from where we are here in Campbell Hall. And questions are welcome. In fact, we have several people ready to go who would like to talk with our guest. The number, if you'd like to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We will start out with somebody here in Belgium, a community nearby, not the country.
No
chocolate. This is Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Once again, good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to point to an example. Historically, maps have a frame of reference. In other words, long ago, a map might have Jerusalem as a center. Today, most maps we look at have North America as a center. You can look at a map with Australia at the center or the North Pole, and many times you can be very, very confused by just the frame of reference. Instead of having north to the top, you could have east to the top, all the time creating a distortion of your information. Now, could this happen in this map that you're talking about by taking a point of view on your type of map you're going to put down would actually influence the way people look at it?
Definitely. So this is a very good question, actually. So what is happening is there are two intertwined questions, I think, which you're asking. One is, who has paid for the map? Because those people are going to be in the middle. And that's why we were so happy when we figured out that our layout algorithms and the kind of procedure which we apply to the data actually results in this donut-shaped design and structure, because nothing seems to be in the middle, given the current best algorithms which we use to generate this base map. The second question which you are referring or asking is, what kind of metaphors and what kind of reference systems might be most beneficial in order to depict what we collectively know? And it is a very abstract semantic space, a space which we can never go to. And you yourself, you know how little you actually know the places which you didn't travel to yet. So we have to find a good way which actually fits very well our pre-conceptualization of what we know. And so the display at the New York Public Library right now has 6 proposals for different reference systems, just node link, for different metaphors, just node link diagrams or semantic layouts or geospatial layouts or some others. And it also has suggestions on what kind of reference systems might work well, namely time series or geospatial maps again, or semantic spaces onto which you can then overlay more information.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm here now looking at, I finally managed to get to your website at Indiana, and people, if they want to go there, can take a look at this, some of the things in this Places and Spaces exhibition, if they're interested in actually seeing some of these various kinds of maps that we're talking about, going from those that the kind of map that we're used to, the idea of the map of the physical space, you know, like the map of the world or the map of the United States, and then going on to looking at some of these maps, kind of maps of knowledge. So that's that's would help people, I guess, to visualize what it is we're talking about.
And the website is HTTP and then :// and then VW for virtual worlds. It's an interesting story why this is there. .Indiana, like the state, .edu for education. And then you are
That was it. It's that one right there. Yeah.
Places and spaces.
Places and spaces.
So it's all lowercase and an ampersand in the middle.
Okay. And actually what I did, that maybe the easiest place to get it, I just went to the Indiana University website and I put in your name and I eventually got here. I'm slow in cyberspace, but eventually, sooner or later, I get to where I'm going. Let's talk with some more people who are listening here. Champagne is next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I was glad that you brought up Leonardo da Vinci in one of your examples, because that gets to the point that I want to ask about, which is that your, what should I say, definitions of knowledge or scholarship tends to be very focused on what we in the West call science. It leaves out, it seems to me, art, music, literature, poetics. I could go on. But it seems that there's whole spheres of human, call it knowledge or at least activity, that seems to be left out, at least in what you've spoken of so far. Now, it might be that you've included it and not mentioned that, but certainly music, to start with one. I don't hear any discussion of all the different aspects of music, Western music, Eastern music, etc.
I totally agree, and we are aware and we are interested in enticing those communities to take better care of their data, which means digitizing the holdings they have and making it available in a form so that they can actually feed into the generation of those maps. As you might know, there are very few scholarly repositories of publications in the humanities. At least it's much less published and available than for some of the hardcore sciences. And so whatever data is available, we try to actually fold into those maps. But the hope is also that by people recognizing how useful those maps are for giving people back a bird's eye view and having them navigate to interesting patches of information and having them also understand the structure and evolution of certain areas of mankind's knowledge. And I really mean all of mankind's scholarly knowledge. Then they would actually get together their resources or go to NSF, go to other funding agencies to actually digitize their holdings.
So you wouldn't be including, let us say, archaeological information about found in China, found in India, and all the cave paintings, etc.?
Right now, we exclusively use publications and patents and grant data, and some business data is sneaking in, which is great to see because there's an interesting interplay between what we are doing in our ivory towers and what the public actually really needs in terms of products and innovations and medicines and cures, etc. But ultimately, a reference system to our knowledge could be very well also used to refer to other items such as physical objects or ideas which are not written up in papers or publications, etc.
Okay. Thank you.
I guess that this points to the, I suppose, the concern that some people have that if we're moving to a digital world where information is going to be stored and manipulated in a digital way, then are there either some things that can't get digitized that we can't do that to, or are there? Will there be some things we say, well, we're not going to bother with that because it's not important, and then in fact something will be lost because someone hasn't taken the time or the expense or they haven't said that it was important enough to have it digitized, and it will end up being forgotten or crumbling or being lost because it hasn't made the jump to this new kind of format.
Yeah, I'm deeply impressed by the success of the Wikipedia project, which Jimmy Wales is spearheading, I should say. it seems that in many cases what you would really like to have is to use the wisdom of all of us to keep back better care of what we collectively know, because we might actually really use it and need it to preserve our species, preserve our planet. And we as human beings, given the amount of brain power we have, and it's not really increasing, at least not for me, and probably also not for my children. It's just changing very, very slowly, which might be a good thing. We have to find a way to actually interconnect all our wisdoms. And the Wikipedia project is a great example of how actually the wisdom of crowds can produce something which is very, very useful and provides access to knowledge to many people in many different languages, and also access to information which is in some cases also physical, and just provides a pointer to where a certain object can be found.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We'll go to another Champagne caller, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm not surprised at your results with the kids, but I dispute that they learn to deal with maps. I think that the human mind inherently has ability to distinguish between close and far, between like and dislike, or that is similar and dissimilar. And that's really the result of your one of the that's really what's caused the results there. The kids weren't trained it. Another interesting thing is that we don't deal very well with higher dimensions as humans. I can picture a one-dimensional line, even a circular continuum like the donut. Certainly two dimensions in maps, and it's worth noting that not all maps show relative closeness. Some show relative areas and so on, but you're talking about ones that show relative closeness. And I can picture two-dimensional maps and even three-dimensional games and maps and objects. But four and higher dimensions, I just can't picture. So to deal with that, I think all humans swap the dimensions we're dealing with at a time so that we make judgments based on relatively little information, relatively few dimensions, which brings me to my second point and kind of challenge. And that is that knowledge itself is pretty flexible stuff. You've mentioned several times collective knowledge, and yeah, that would be that'd be good to have. But probably the strength of mankind's ability to survive is not collective, but rather individual variation in knowledge. And when you start talking about the cognitive maps of individuals, well, everybody's different. And I submit that once you have gotten a bunch of people together to come up with a general map that they all agree on, your results are just, they're determined already. Once a bunch of people decide what science is like, of course science is going to be mapped like that. Linnaeus makes us look the right way at biology, and one study I remember showed that differences in sound quality made by humans could be accurately mapped into the placement of the tongue in the mouth when making those vowels, for instance. So it had our perception of vowels has some physical reality, but most things don't. Most things are just concepts and highly idiomatic, and I doubt that that your research path will ever lead to much more than a map of the obvious. Could you have some comments, and I'll hang up.
Yeah, sure. I picked out four different questions, very interesting, each of them. One was the question why children might be able to read maps. And I think in many cases, we actually experience our world spatially. We are born in this three-dimensional world, and we organize our lives very much spatially. We organize our work spatially. If you look into some of the professors' offices or some of your co-workers or your own office, you will see most likely piles of books and piles of papers and piles of other things. And many of us know exactly what pile contains what. And this kind of spatial memory which we have is actually underutilized. It was used back in the Greek times when people memorized eight-hour-long speeches with the help of so-called memory palaces, where they basically walked through this environment and picked up different objects to actually then lecture from those facts they had associated with those objects. So I think we think spatially, but the search engines which we are using today to access everything we know, they give us a list. So I think we could have one more dimension. But then again, this is the second question I picked out from your questions. You have a high-dimensional data space, namely, for example, let's take Lee Giles' Sightseer project. A while back in time, it had about 600,000 documents. We picked out 40,000 unique terms, unique words, which appeared in those papers, actually in the abstracts of those papers only. So you have a 600,000 by 40,000 matrix, and the cells inside this matrix are either one, if this word appeared in this document, or you could even count them, so they have counts of how often it occurred. And it's zero if this word didn't appear in this abstract. So you have this high-dimensional data space, and now you want to communicate this to a person like me or my mom or somebody else. And what you try to do is to break it down into a dimensionality which we can actually make sense of. And in many cases, this is 2D because 3D is cool, but you can't really operate it with the kind of 2D interfaces we have. Plus, you have occlusion. Plus, you can't use color because things which are farther away are dimmer. So you use a major way of encoding information. Similarly, you can't use sizes anymore because things which are farther away are smaller. So you lose a lot if you actually go into 3D. So let's say we are stuck with 2D. So you convert your 600,000 times 40,000 data space into 2D, and surely you lose information on the way. On the other hand, the donut, which I mentioned before, actually has quite rich structure. Especially you can zoom into different areas and you see more and more structure. And so I think I would really encourage you to go to the online website for Places and Spaces. And we recently got a lot of press, so probably if you type in Places and Spaces Mapping Science, you will get all kinds of international and national press because of the exhibit we just opened last week in New York. And then again, I think a fourth question, which is very, very important, is the validation of those maps. How can researchers today, which are highly specialized because they have to in order to contribute new knowledge, how can they evaluate a map which is a million times bigger than what they oversee, what the expertise area they are covering? And you could go ahead and have an expert panel look at these maps and zoom gradually into the areas which they are familiar with and evaluate that those are correct. And ideally, you would be able to patchwork all their differently evaluated pieces of maps together into the whole map. So you would really need probably a million researchers to do this, but it could be an interesting exercise. However, all those different researchers have very subjective views of their own area of expertise, and they also have regionally different views. And depending on their research interests, they also might have a focus on different aspects of the very same research area. So it becomes very tricky, actually, to do a validation of those maps, which is clearly necessary. So we do a combination of those human expert consulting validations and validations on a grand scale where we use, for instance, ISI-assigned keywords to find the best combination of data cleaning, data analysis, layout, and visualization algorithms, which results in maps of science which are locally consistent and accurate, but also globally accurate. And there are papers on this, which you can find on my website.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Kathy Brunner is our guest. She teaches at Indiana University in Bloomington, where she is Associate Professor of Information Science, Adjunct Associate Professor of Informatics, Core Faculty Member of Cognitive Science, Research Affiliate of the Biocomplexity Institute, and she is here visiting the campus to give a talk in a series. This is an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study, The Age of Networks, Social, Cultural, and Technological Connections. She is a part of a series that's co-sponsored by the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and the folks in the Department of Speech Communication, and she'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 1 at the building of the Center for Supercomputing Applications. So if you're interested in attending that, you should feel welcome. I'm sure it's open to anybody who would like to stop by. Questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone else. Champaign County here, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'll just put these out and then hang up and listen. One thing is there's a web
search engine called Kadoo that results in a graphical kind of representation of connections. And I'm not sure it's very good yet, but again, as you implied about your publicity on your thing, that it gets better as it gets more use. So if more people tried Kadoo and looked at it, it might make it better. As long ago as 5 or 6 years ago, Apple had a thing called XSpace, where they graphically depicted metadata and connections and that kind of thing. And you could actually click and hold and sort of fly through topics. Now, that was sort of, I think it was prototypic and all, but is that, I haven't been in front of the computer since you've been talking, is that the kind of thing you're talking about? And I think one of the things that we're talking here then is that maps, since it connotes the two dimensions, that you might maps and something, or meta maps or something like that, so that it immediately liberates you from thinking in terms of the two-dimensional map. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, very good question. And thanks for asking this one also. So Kadoo gives you actually a different semantic space for each of the many search queries you might issue. And you have to learn each and every one of those abstract semantic spaces for each single query you are sending out, meaning you are confronted with this abstract alien space which you can never go to, and it's a different one every time. And I doubt people are interested in learning so many abstract semantic spaces. I think it would be much wiser to have one map, and instead of recreating it in a different layout all the time, have this one map overlaid with the search results you actually got. And this way you would see, you got 3 in mathematics, 2 in physics, not interested in those two, but maybe you were interested in the ones in the cancer research area, and then you zoom in there, or at least you select those, and then you can get details on demand and get your web page or PDF document, etc. So people have tried to do visual interfaces to search engines, and it's not working because, again, every time you issue a search query, you get a different abstract semantic space, which is totally alien to you, and you have to make sense of it, and it takes too long, and you're not very productive this way. See, fly through topics, which you mentioned, is probably cool if it's well done. However, cool doesn't mean that it's really meaningful or useful, and there is a lot of eye candy out there in the information visualization community, which is a young community, so some might be excused. But there are also a lot of researchers now that strive for aesthetically pleasing and well-designed visualizations that conform to human visual perception principles and our cognitive abilities to process visual information, and at the same time also provide insights, provide actionable knowledge to you. So we are interested in the latter, not in the cool fly-throughs.
All right, and let's go again. We'll go to Champagne Line 1 for another caller. Hello.
Hello. I was just wondering if there was similar classifications in other fields. I'm currently studying math at graduate level, and we have an AMS, American Math Society, classification for different branches of mathematics, and in that people, you know, when it's reviewed and the author, we write down the numbers which closely approximate what area we're writing the paper in. Do other fields have a classification of similar sorts? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Definitely, there exists many taxonomies, classification hierarchies, ontologies, also directory structures, the directory structures in which you organize your files into. So in many cases, those classification hierarchies and taxonomies have been generated to make sense, to give us something to hold on to in this flood of information, to make sense of the data we are facing. And in many cases, those taxonomies are huge. We recently worked on a project to visualize the USPTO classification hierarchy. This is the United States Trademark Patent Office classification hierarchy, organizing all the 7 million patents which have been granted there. And this taxonomy is, if you just print it in 1PT type font and some major levels in 2PT type font, so that you can actually make sense of them. And if you then print them on a long scrolling piece of paper only the first three levels, not down to the 13th level in this hierarchy. If you just print the first three, then it fills a long scrolling piece of paper of about 5 meter length. It's huge, and it's one PT type one, so it's really amazing to me to see how big this taxonomy actually is. And again, there are human beings which try to optimize this taxonomy so that it fits the incoming stream of patents, and then they organize the new patents into this taxonomy. And the tool which we are working on is a so-called taxonomy validation tool, which helps you to see the goodness of fit between your data and the classifications you have generated to characterize and to organize your data. So you will actually see in how far the patents in this case, which are organized under the same classification, if they are similar to each other, or if you have one or two outliers which actually do not belong. Or if you have a sequence of new patents coming into the same class, which gets more and more dissimilar from the core of the patents inside this class. And you can use visualization techniques to actually give people a very fast bird's eye view of how good their classification hierarchy is and how well it represents the underlying data.
All right, well, we're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left. I want to ask you about something that's maybe a little bit different, but I know it is something that you're interested in. For a while now, people who write speculative fiction have been playing with the idea that inside the computer, maybe if you think about it that way, that there is a kind of a space. You can think about it as being a kind of a landscape. That's something like the physical landscape that we live in. And probably the first person to write about this, at least the guy I think who probably gets credit for this, is William Gibson, mm-hmm. who seems to have coined the term cyberspace. Mm-hmm. And I think that now, you know, there are different people who have different ways of describing the same thing. And a lot of people have taken his ideas and run with them in a lot of ways in science fiction. And I expect that probably there were scientists that at the first time they read that, they said, oh, well, they had been thinking about that themselves, or scientists who read that and said, sure, why not? That raises this strange and interesting question about, do you think that there would be ever a way for human beings to in some way enter into that space? You know, think about it as if it was another kind of a landscape existing in some other dimension, some way that we could actually go there and walk around in it. I mean, that's sort of the idea. Is that something, do you think, that is so outlandish that it makes a good story? You would say, well, that makes a good story, but that we're never going to do that. Or that somewhere in inside of you, you think, well, you know, it may be sometime we actually could do that.
Interesting question. I have to say that I actually really like the body I have, so I'm not really keen to.
You're not going to digitize yourself and go off.
Maybe in 100 years it might be a little different. Maybe then I'm desperate to leave it and just upload myself there. But on the other hand, I also know, and there are cool books out there on this by Greg Rawlins, for instance, who is an IU Bloomington faculty member, telling how we are actually drawn to technology, like Moth to the Flame, which is actually the title of one of his books, or Slaves of the Machine, which is another title of one of his books. And in these books, you actually learn how much we are just desperate to interconnect to those machines around us. And computers, and particularly the internet, which was turned on 30 years ago and is on since then, maybe it's the only machine which runs since 30 years, they are definitely among the most coolest devices we have generated and created for ourselves so far. So I could very well imagine that people are drawn to live in online communities, and they are. And many of those people have double personalities and identities, and they live a major part of their life already in those 3D virtual environments. On the other hand, I find it also very interesting how we can actually use those machines to make sense of what we collectively know and how we can use them to interconnect the brains which we have on this planet. And in a recent study, we could actually show that there is a global brain emerging on this planet, at least with the data that we had, and that science is driven by prolific single expert. It's not by prolific single experts, but by high-impact co-authorship teams.
Maybe the question is more not so much, do you want to upload yourself, but can you imagine, because sometimes the way that we use these machines, it's difficult, you know. It's sort of a mismatch of machine and human being. If there was some way to more directly, in a sense, interface with the machine. But I suppose that, again, that goes back to the idea of plugging yourself into it.
Yeah, the interfaces are definitely crappy. All the interfaces which we have designed.
There is a great understatement.
managed to design for ourselves so far, really crappy. There's this great joke where these extraterrestrials come to our planet and they try to figure out how we used to look like, because apparently all the biological material is gone, but all the technology is still available. And they come back with this one-eyed person with long fingers and only one ear and all those, which really is what those interfaces are made for, but they are not made for us right now.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to stop. I want to again say thanks very much to our guest, Kati Bonner. She is an associate professor of information science at Indiana University of Bloomington. She is here visiting the campus to take part in this initiative of the Center for Advanced Study, The Age of Networks, Social, Cultural, and Technological Connections, part of a distinguished speaker series that's co-sponsored by the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and the Department of Speech Communication. And she'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 1:00. This is at the building, at the NCSA building, room 1040, talking about maps, mapping the structure and diffusion of scholarly knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you.